Today's episode of Gluck Radio is proudly brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks, offering titles in every genre. Now, I want you to go and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/gluckradio. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. If you're a fan of this show, you might like to download American Savage by my fellow podcaster and sex advice columnist, Dan Savage. Or how about Crush It? Why now is the time to cash in on your passion by Gary Vaynerchuk. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. We all have different beliefs as to what happens after death, but how many of us question what happens as we're dying? What visions, experiences, and emotions do we feel? Investigated author Patricia Pearson asks that very question in her compelling new book, Opening Heaven's Door, in which she sheds light on everything from near-death experiences to telepathically sensing a loved one dying from hundreds or thousands of miles away. For every extraordinary and supernatural statistic, there are dozens of scientific studies backing them up. If you're scoffing at the notion of ghosts and out-of-body experiences, you might be just like the 18th century scientist who laughed at the notion of meteorites. Science is going in startling directions, and when it comes to the most feared time of any person's life, the truth is nothing short of astounding. Patricia, welcome. So my first question to you, besides thanking you so much for coming on to our show and bringing a topic that is literally, you know, I've been doing executive life coaching and medical hypnosis for 37 years. This is a topic that everyone is on everyone's mind. What happens after death? Now, the death of your father and sister led to a strange experience that made you write the book. Tell our audience what happened.
Well, what happened was in 2008, my father died very unexpectedly in the middle of the night. He went into cardiac arrest. He wasn't ailing. And my sister happened to be awake in her bedroom in Montreal. And she, sort of gazing into the semi-darkness, she suddenly became aware of a presence in her bedroom. This was nothing that had ever happened to her before, so it was quite vivid. It actually had the effect of feeling hands cupping the back of her head gently, so there was a tactile element to the presence. And then she felt suffused with a kind of really difficult to describe infusion of peacefulness and elation and contentment, these kinds of emotions, which were very alien to her at that particular time because she had been dealing with cancer and had been very frightened for about a year. So it was a total revelation to her to be having these feelings. It was almost as if the way that, you know, you suddenly OxyContin takes effect or something. You know, there's a palpable shift in your emotions. And this went on for about an hour and a half. There were some visions involved of her unborn granddaughter. The whole thing was amazing to her, and she told her...
Now, when you say visions, she's actually saw these things as opposed to thought of them.
She was watching herself play with her as-yet-unconceived sort of five-month-old granddaughter who was named Katie. And she was helping her sort of sit up gently on the bed. I didn't have a chance to have a long conversation with Catherine about this at the time because we got caught up in Dad being dead and the funeral and so on. But I remember her saying that it was a kind of waking dream almost.
Okay.
And again, it was just, you know, absolutely riveting to her. And then she emailed my her boyfriend and described all of this. And then after that, she found out that my father was dead. So, you know, it could have been a collision of two remarkable events in our family's life, one being her having an unprecedented experience, the other being the unexpected death of the patriarch. We can't say for sure, but she certainly interpreted it as being him coming to her and reassuring and consoling her before going on his way. And in a sense, that just made so much perfect resonant sense to the whole family that none of us disagreed. It was really profound.
Patricia, do you feel that science rejects this simply because they can't prove it right, or that it's just doesn't fit into their understanding of how the universe works?
I think the latter. Certainly what I found after that experience, and I went on to do the research for this book, was that this kind of what I'm beginning to call a crisis impression, where people pick up on somebody dying or in distress in the moment or hour of that encounter or experience, is incredibly common. It's actually remarkably common. And, you know, why science can't sort of approach it and examine it, there hasn't been any research done on this since 1963, even though it's remarkably prevalent. There's something between 45 and 53% of the bereaved population has this kind of experience. That's huge. So then I question, well, why haven't we looked at this closely? And of course, the answer basically is just prejudice. So it's just the assumption that it can't be true. Therefore, all of these people, about half the population, are credulous and wishful.
Yeah, I think the fear is this. I think the fear is that even though there is something there, even from a scientific basis, such as energy cannot be created or destroyed, so therefore something happens with this energy, they are just afraid that there are so many crackpots out there that they're going to be flooded, and they don't want to do the research to, you know, pick out, you know, what is feasible and possible and relevant, you know, from some of the other stuff. That's my...
Yeah, I think so, exactly. And in fact, right now I'm applying for some research money to try to get at that sifting between, you know, genuinely sort of inexplicable experiences and ones where people might have, you know, gone back and confabulated or whatever, and, you know, see what are the circumstances in which people have these genuine experiences. I mean, you do hypnosis, right?
I do hypnosis. I've done it for 37 years, yes.
So a lot of the telepathy research has found, as you probably know, that there are certain states of consciousness that are more conducive to picking up these, what you might call these fainter signals. And certainly in the Ganseld telepathy experiments, it's that sort of reduced stimulus situation. So my sister sitting in a quiet bedroom in the middle of the night would be a perfect scenario, whereas my mother, who was lying right beside my father, had no idea that he died.
Well, it makes sense to me on so many different levels. You know, my dog, Socrates, and my wife heard me call him my dog. We just call him our son, you know, even though I have two amazing daughters, but he's really close to us. He knows when it's Monday, and he doesn't want to need to go back to work, and he is miserable, and if I'm not feeling well and my wife isn't, he knows it immediately, even when we're sleeping.
Right.
You know, so if animals could pick up, you know, on what's going on inside of you, and, you know, we know that whales and dolphins are able to communicate from miles away, why is this such an unusual thing for human beings to have?
Right, exactly. And in fact, it would have made evolutionary sense to be able to develop a capacity to pick up signals over distance. And why there's such resistance to that idea baffles me, because so what? You know, so what if that's the case? It's fascinating to me that we have so much trouble with that.
People have resistance because it doesn't fit into their worldview, not because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
question, why do some dying talk about travel tickets and bus schedules and stuff? I mean, is there an interesting connection between taking a trip and talking about that stuff?
Yeah, one of the areas that I wound up looking at in my book had to do with something called nearing-death awareness, which is not a near-death experience, but is actually what hospice staff are beginning to witness in the sort of quieter realms of palliative care settings, which is that people begin to have a kind of interesting shift in consciousness toward sort of the last 72 hours of their lives, where in some cases they'll begin to talk about travel. So they may not be able to speak much at all, but all of a sudden what they do say is related to, I want to go home, where are my shoes, I need my passport. Ironically, a good friend of mine the other day called me and said her father was ill, but there was no immediate prognosis of death. And she called me and said, Dad's suddenly talking about catching the train. Should I go out to see him? And I said, yes, absolutely, based on my research now. And sure enough, she got out there and he died the next day. So there's an inward sense that the dying have that doesn't correlate with their physical prognosis of when they're going to die, and they see it as passage, as journey. They don't seem to see it as annihilation.
Patricia, when I grew up, one of the cartoons around was Casper the Friendly Ghosts.
Yeah.
Now, do you believe in ghosts or hallucinations, and what's the difference? Tell me what you think about ghosts, because you did a TED Talk about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because I think the word ghost has become so loaded in our culture, and we see it in terms of spooky and rattly chains and or, you know, ridiculous sort of salt shaker-shaped sheets or Casper. That we've actually lost touch with the fact that throughout human history, people have been aware of and interacting with their ancestors, walking around, identifiably being their ancestors, not being some sort of transformed, scary figure, and that these figures have been very comforting. So another element of nearing-death awareness is the witnessing of these visions of deceased ancestors. And there has been some pretty solid research on that shows that they're different than hallucinations, because the hallucinations will be fragmentary and disorienting and arbitrary. So, you know, all of a sudden you're seeing, you know, a black bear at the end of your bed.
So, Patricia, what are ghosts, and do you believe in them? You know, one of my clients would be frightened to think that his mother-in-law would still be around. But what are ghosts? What are they actually?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, there's speculation that what we're actually seeing is, let's say there's a dimension right beside us that is parallel to this one, which is where people go when they die. But it's, you know, it's not like in the sky. It's actually a near dimension to us, and we can somehow sort of pick up on the presence of the people around us who are in that dimension. But I mean, you know, nobody knows, obviously, and you know, so it just comes down to saying, well, it's just not, it doesn't exist, it's all in your head, or saying, well, no, it does exist, we just don't know how. But I mean, for example, one of the women that I interviewed for my book, her father came in, he'd been dead for 6 weeks, and sat in the pickup truck of her car while she was driving on the highway, and it was a very specific entry point, 20 miles exit. So she had an incredibly specific and vivid sense of him sitting beside her in her car for 20 miles, and then off he went. So what is that? You know, who knows? But
no,
it's
right,
phenomenon
correct.
That occurs all the time.
Meaning what it does is it opens up this challenge. I have never in my life ever one day been afraid of death, because I don't really believe in it. I believe that there's transformation. From someone who studied neuroplasticity and is an expert in it, there's a difference between the body, the brain, and the mind, which sits on top and interacts with the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the energy, the thoughts, the memories, and so on and so forth, that part of us which is energy does go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea where it goes, but I don't believe, you know, that Earth is the last stop of the journey, for sure. I am curious about telepathy in the sense that why have the animals, many animals, developed a greater sense of telepathy than Homo sapiens?
I don't think they have. I think the difference is that we have become much better at filtering out that kind of stimulus, partly because we have invested so heavily in the idea of the rational mind, and so we are averse to picking up any kind of signal, and then also because we're so surrounded by, you know, it'd be like trying to hear somebody call your name in a nightclub at 2 a.m. That, you know, one of the things you find is that if you go and you look in indigenous cultures, for instance, in remote northern Canada, where there's, you know, profound surrounding silence and very, very little kind of static, if you will, they're still using that kind of communication method. So similarly, in Peruvian shamans will use, there's a chemical actually in the ayahuasca plant called telamine, which heightens the capacity for telepathy between shamans. So I mean, it's going on.
Right, but see, this is where some people would say, well, yeah, you take LSD and you're going to find there's a lot more telepathy. Meaning, which part is telepathy heightened, or is the hallucinatory belief in telepathy heightened?
Well, you can't hallucinate the fact that you can pick up on somebody else's thought. So if they confirm that that's the thought that they were just having, that's not a hallucination.
Right. If they confirm it, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's actually true. So what is this plant, by the way? I need to order it on the internet.
It's actually a component of ayahuasca, and they're just beginning to do some controlled experiments around this because it has been said for, you know, centuries that telamine has this capacity. That's actually why it's even called that. But it's never actually been studied experimentally until very recently. So there are two plants involved in ayahuasca an administered drug. One of them is the hallucinogenic part, but the other plant is the one that contains telamine. So if you take away the hallucinogenic plant and you only administer telamine, then you see what happens.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Why are supernatural forces so common on battlefields?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because certainly that's come up in the research, is that people in situations of war or prisoners of war or in situations of extreme danger actually encounter a kind of sensed presence that's not necessarily a deceased relative one way or the other, but is some sort of accompanying or helping presence. And at first this was something people were aware of during World War One, and it, you know, everybody thought, oh, well, that's just the sort of superstitions of the era. But then they started to begin to see that it was also happening in polar expeditions, climbing Mount Everest, people lost at sea, in situations of rape. So all of a sudden it's going on across different scenarios, and it's the same phenomenon, which is of this sensed presence suddenly appearing, not necessarily visually appearing, but accompanying the person out of the danger zone and then disappearing. And that I find fascinating, because it has nothing to do with grief or wishful thinking or any of those factors. It's totally unrelated to that, and yet it's very similar as a phenomenon. So what is that? You know, our ancestors would have called that guardian angels.
Yeah, I might still call it guardian angels.
Yeah.
Virtually everyone who senses that death is imminent reports an overwhelming feeling of peace. Now, not everyone does, but most do. What do you think accounts for that? Is it just that it's all over now and I can let my guard down? I don't have to be worried about what people think of me? Or is something really happening?
Well, certainly there have been a few studies done in hospice in the UK in the last 5 years where they've found that the uptick in mood toward the very end of life correlates with people having seen these kind of deathbed visions. So if they see somebody who's there to take them away, oh, look, mom's there, you know, mom's come to get me, or their ex-husband or whatever, that will correlate with this uptick of kind of peaceful emotion. And in fact, that's one of the ways they distinguish deathbed visions from hallucinations, because hallucinations don't have a corresponding emotional effect on the patient. So, you know, is it because they feel relieved that they're not alone, as opposed to that they can just give up and die now? I don't, you know, who knows? It's a remarkable thing. I don't know why, but there it is. It's happening all over the place in hospice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, it's somewhere a combination between the knowledge that begins to open up. We use a very small percentage of our brain that there is something else out there, and that this is simply just another transition. It's between that and the guy thinking, now it's your turn to pay the bills, and I don't have to worry about it. So it's
actually, I remember interviewing one guy who'd had a near-death experience, and he said that end-of-life kind of serenity is the result of realizing that you can now finally give up the illusion of separateness, that you can finally give up pretending that you aren't part of a universal whole, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's interesting as well. Near-death experiences, did you ever have one?
No. I'm jealous.
I actually did have one, a very, yeah, very strange one, and this is when I was in college working at a number of different jobs because I paid for my own school and I was out of the house. And I had, it was in a warehouse, and I had a more or less an anvil fall about 15, 20 feet, hit me in the head, and I was, you know, gone for the count. And according to those who were around, I wasn't moving, I wasn't breathing, whatever the case might be. I just remember being outside of my body looking at myself and just observing, you know. There was no white light for me, but it was definitely, absolutely nothing frightening or scary. That was my only experience.
Right.
You know, and because at the end of it, you know, the injuries were not as bad as one might have, you know, in a fatal car accident, because I guess I'm hard-headed. I don't know if that would even qualify as a near-death experience. But, and I also have had situations where there were ice storms and on the highway and cars were spinning out of control and you just didn't even bother touching your wheel and feeling extremely peaceful.
Yeah.
But I wonder, I do wonder how much of that is, and I'm fascinated from what you said, of our lack of understanding that we're part of the universe and we need to have more of a respect for that, and even that we're part of one another. And there's such a breakdown of respect for just humans really treating humans as human beings.
Yeah.
Between that and the frustration of life and people saying, you know what, this is a hard thing to do. If it's over, thank God.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, certainly the people that I've interviewed who have had really deep near-death experiences, what they all have in common when they talk about it is this sort of revelation that we're all connected, and this sense that they wind up merging in an ocean of consciousness. And, you know, but they maintain their singular awareness, but so they merge into this larger consciousness.
So why did you say that many people who've had near-death experiences actually get depressed and some even try to kill themselves? What, where would that fit in?
Because what happens is they have this experience that of a reality that they describe as 1,000 times more real than this reality, than this embodied reality. So it's not like a dream. It's not like a hallucination. It's totally different than that. It's the most real experience that's ever happened to them in their lives. And then they try to tell people about it, and they're ridiculed. So that's where the depression comes in.
I get it.
And or the yearning to return to that place.
I get it. Okay, so they're not depressed because they have it. They're depressed because no one appreciates it, and they just want to go back.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so the scariest aspect of near-death experience stories are the ones in which the patient perceives things out of the body while they're in a coma. Talk about that. I mean, what happens when a person is actually seeing himself in a hospital room and watching what's going on? Is that an hallucination or is that a near-death experience?
Well, I mean, it's an element of the near-death experience, coming out of your body as you did and observing yourself. And, of course, it's the only piece of the experience that anyone else can try to use as an evidentiary piece. So there's always all kinds of bickering going on about, you know, did this person actually see this particular kind of saw that they never would have seen before being used on their head from a vantage point that they couldn't have seen with their real eyes, or did they somehow invented after as, you know, a perfect match for the scenario, and so on. And so right now there's an international study going on, including in hospitals in New York, where they've got these plates on the ceiling, like cue cards kind of, hanging from the ceiling of cardiac wards, because that's where you're going to find, you know, most people going into cardiac arrest and resuscitation. And they're waiting for somebody to go out of body and see the symbols that are on top of those cards.
So, and are you sure that they were symbols, or were those the charges?
No, they're symbols, because they're trying to see whether they can say, "Hey, I went up, you know, I came out of body and I saw, you know, the yin yang symbol on the ceiling of the room." It
that's
was so
really,
weird.
That's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, so, you know, they're waiting to see what happens with that. So the fact that even got funded.
In your experience, did you grow up with religion? Are you religious? Do you believe in God?
Yes, I do. I believe in a spiritual universe. I don't know precisely what it looks like, but I grew up as an Episcopalian, essentially, so that's kind of like tea and cake on Sunday, you know?
So, but I actually, you know, do agree that there is something in the universe that holds it together and then makes it make sense, even though right now it doesn't seem to make sense.
Yes.
So I would. How has your understanding of God changed through this process of near-death experiences?
Because, you know, by following the data rather than the doctrine, by following the evidence of what people report, that's given me a picture of what that world looks like. And so, you know, people will talk about going into an ocean of light that is also love, that is also wisdom. So it's like a kind of multi-sensory, powerful kind of ocean of consciousness, in which there is a tremendous amount of unconditional love, in which it's conveyed to people that the only thing that matters when they come back to their, you know, embodied lives is love and how people love one another. And then you go back and you look at all the different scriptures, and of course they all say that, but it just gets obscured by rules and regulations and judgments. And so, you know, a coherent picture begins to emerge from just modern people who've had near-death experiences and how those experiences compare to the reports of mystics, for instance. And so I feel totally comfortable in having a sense that there is no one particular religious perspective that's correct, that really all that matters is that we practice compassion.
No, I mean, I would completely agree with you. I wonder to myself out loud, you know, there are so many people, you know, maybe the majority of people in this world who literally are born into a life of misery and live in a life of misery. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's extreme poverty, how, if at all, does suffering add anything to the quality of one's life or spirituality? You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of the importance of suffering as a means of deepening and growing as a spiritual being. And I don't think suffering is some sort of like random punishment. And I think that once you enter into a kind of spiritual world, you have a radically shifted perspective on what the purpose of your suffering may have been. And for me, you know, when I switch it around that way in my head, then, you know, every time something difficult happens to me, I don't feel the same sense of self-pity about it that I did 10 years ago. Instead, I feel like, you know, this is a chance for me to evolve as a human being. And then the other side of that I want to say is that one of the things that drives me up the wall about sort of intellectual atheists is that they would deprive people who are in extreme poverty or in enslavement or in, you know, severe chronic disease situations of their faith in their God because it's not fashionable for the atheists. I just find that incredibly irritating because it's like when you go back and you look at what African slaves in America held to for 150 years, obviously, you know, it was their God. And
I agree with you. I think that atheism is you could afford to be an atheist if you grew up wealthy without pain.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore you have a life that's so comfortable that this could be all that there is.
Yeah, exactly.
Though I do think that they should be allowed to vote. If any atheists are listening, we're not going to take away your vote. Your father, your sister, they died. Did you have good relationships with them?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think, you know, I went on a long journey of, you know, of wrestling with my own skepticism and my own, you know, rationalism and, in a way, kind of refusing entry to either my father or my sister if they were still, you know, out there to reach for me. And so they died in 2008. And I think, you know, the funny thing is that very summer, one night, I was in a state of extreme anguish, particularly over my sister, and I said, you know, if you're there somewhere, please, please let me know. And the next morning I got up and I went into my hallway and I had a plant that someone had given me about 8 months earlier that I had just stopped watering. And it was dead. I mean, it was flat out dead. I just hadn't thrown it out because I was just a mess at that time. And there was a huge, vibrant fuchsia bloom on this plant. I mean, like a time lapse. Bloom. And at the time, I noticed it, and I thought, well, that can't mean anything. That's a coincidence, so I'm just going to ignore that. And so it was only for, you know, several years later that in retrospect, looking at a couple of instances like that, that I'm now willing to say, you know, that was Catherine saying, it's okay, you're okay. But it's amazing how long it took for me to allow that to be the case.
That's interesting. I wonder, you know, if the great blanket that separates this world, you know, from the next world is there so that we have to deal with life in this world and learn what we have to learn. Though, you know, every time I say that, I realize, you know, through my practice and my experiences that without intervention, people do not grow up, they just grow old. Growing up is not something that comes with age. It comes with introspection and really looking at oneself.
Right.
In your experience, when someone has a vision of a parent who has an experience and interaction with the ghosts, how does the psychiatric community treat them when they go and they share it?
Well, they suggest that it's a grief hallucination. And, you know, so when I was first doing research for the book, and I heard that bandied about, grief hallucination, so I went to do some research on what it meant. And lo and behold, it's not based on anything in terms of evidentiary science. You know, there's no proof that a human being can willfully conjure the image of somebody who's died just because they're sad. Not only that, but in fact, we don't even know why schizophrenics hallucinate. Like, we don't even understand the causative mechanism in the brain for more well-known hallucinations. So this is purely an assumption. It's like saying, okay, these things are happening to people, therefore they must be hallucinations. And that's the state of the science right now. Maybe they'll prove that they are hallucinations, but at the moment, They have no proof of that at all.
What I find interesting is that when those who have certain mental illnesses, extreme mental illnesses, approach death, they become more lucid and more rational. You know, in my mind, you know, some of the fears that their illnesses were there to protect them from vanish, and therefore they become more, you know, they become more comfortable, you know, within their own brain. But tell me what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, are you referring to end of life sort of lucidity?
Yes.
So you've seen that?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, they're just beginning to do some really interesting research on that. They call it terminal lucidity, and they're seeing it in cases of people who've had Alzheimer's, stroke, brain tumor, severe mental illness, severe developmental disability, where in the very end of their life, like in the last few hours sometimes, their brains will become completely clear, and they'll be able to converse with their family. And, I mean, these are really inexplicable episodes, actually, from a brain-based point of view. So one of my favorite stories that I heard was a research case that came to light recently from 1930s Germany, where there was a woman who was in an institution in Germany, and she'd been institutionalized since infancy. She was so severely, whatever the current word is for retarded, I guess. I don't know if it's developmentally delayed, but, I mean, this was not delayed. This was, like, fundamentally unable to crawl, talk, you know, you name it. She was in a diaper. She had to be fed.
Like extreme autism? Are you thinking of that?
I don't know. I'm not sure what they, the word they would have used at the time would have been the German word for retarded, right? So what that actually would translate to now, I'm not sure. But in any event, she was totally unable to function cognitively. And so she'd been in this institution for 20 years. So she was about 22, I guess. And she was dying of tuberculosis. And the director of the institute and the main physician and the nurse went into her room. And in the last 4 hours before she died, she began singing hymns about the departure of her own soul over and over until she died. And it was such a galvanizing experience that the actual director of the institute became an advocate against the Nazi policy of exterminating the infirm on the basis that the argument would have been, but he was like, no, this woman was there. She was there the whole time, but she didn't surface until the final few hours of her life.
That's really interesting. I'm sure he left Germany quickly after he came out with that statement.
Yeah.
No. I mean, the idea, by the way, of killing the weak and the infirmed was not a original German concept. It was actually it developed in many countries, including our own, at different points in the 20s and 30s. The idea of
eugenics.
Eugenics. You know, it's not. It didn't begin with Nazi Germany. Tell me what your thoughts on people who say and believe that they are psychic. Now, we know that there are a lot of scams out there who prey on people who are dying to hear from their mother or sister for the last time. Tell me what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, I think like any area of human endeavor, you're going to have a full spectrum from people who are full of shit to people who have some kind of highly developed gift. I mean, if you look at writing, for instance, I can tell you that I'm a writer, but, you know, so can the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey. So, that made my dog bark.
No, I thought that was a cue. Has he read the book?
No, but I've read bits of it, and it's just appallingly written. But you know what I mean? It's like in any area, you're going to have people who are frauds. And you're also going to have people who are highly, highly gifted.
Right.
So my sense is that there's that spectrum that's going on in terms of people who claim to be psychic. And in fact, the people that I know who do appear to be psychic don't want it, freaks them out. and they don't want to have anything to do with it.
And you know what? That's my experience, too. Those who are real psychics, number one, never work as one. They just simply keep it, you know, to themselves, and they use it in whatever endeavor in life that they choose.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So I happen to agree. I also think that what happens with people is that it becomes an all or nothing experience, just the way they have faith in their parents or faith in a religious figure. The moment there's a disappointment, I don't trust you anymore. Sometimes with husbands and wives, not realizing that human beings are so flawed that you could have the true gift and yet you have a flaw, and those flaws will come out. You know, and you could have a psychic propensity, and yet you're not picking the lottery numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's like trying to listen to a faint radio signal coming over, you know, a 19th century giant radio. It's not a perfect communication. It doesn't seem to be. What people pick up, they pick up intuitively in flashes. I certainly wouldn't sit down with a psychic and have them tell me anything, because I don't think that's how it works. Whereas what I am finding with these distress and death signals is that, you know, people will have these very sudden, spontaneous awarenesses where, you know, one woman was telling me about how she woke up in the middle of the night because she thought the window in her bedroom had exploded, jumped out of bed, was feeling for glass shards all over her sheets. There wasn't anything there, and she figured she'd had some kind of really weird dream, and then found out the next day that her daughter had gone through the window of a car at that point. So that is psychic, but it's not anything in terms of fortune-telling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I actually heard a story where this father, who's like kind of a health nut, just ran out and got a McDonald's Big Mac, and that at that same time his son was eating a Big Mac, got into a car accident, and his face smashed into the window with the Big Mac. He didn't die, but that happened at the same time. So,
isn't that what a story?
It's really kind of interesting. Well, you know what? One of the things that all this points out, Patricia, is when you think you know everything, you really know quite little. That there's a lot, you know, to open yourself up to, and also at the same time to enjoy the privilege of intellectual skepticism without having to close your mind to the possibility of new things.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what your book has done, and it was wonderfully written. You are a wonderful writer, and thank you so much for coming onto my show.
Oh, my pleasure, and have a great holiday.
You too. I want to once again thank Patricia Pearson for coming on to our show. Go out there and pick up a copy of Patricia's book, Opening Heaven's Door, on Amazon.com. Check out her website at pearsonspost.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. If there is a problem you can't solve, call me at 212-599-3195. I'll solve it for you. Check out our other episodes at gluckradio.com. Keep listening. Keep sending in your feedback. Keep telling everyone to find their favorite program and let us know what it is. Till next time.